Hi, this is Dave Kale. I'm just wondering if you aren't encouraging or taking part in Christianity's elephant in the room. Now, we all know the analogy, an elephant in a room that would be so large, so consuming of the space that it would prevent any freedom of movement for the other folks in the room. You know, it's the elephant. Now, the most common human response to something that big is to ignore it. So the conversation in the room goes to every subject except this huge dominant force. That's the idea behind the analogy of the elephant in the room. Now, occasionally, in various organizations and situations, we encounter the elephant in the room. That one reality, which is so huge that it impacts everything else in its sphere of influence, and our common response is to ignore it. It just seems too big to do anything about it. Now, alas, in the world of 21st century Western Christianity, we have an elephant in the room, a reality so big, so evil, that it impacts all of our mindsets, shapes our thinking, stunts our personal growth, and does more to hinder the spread of Christianity than any other single issue, and yet we routinely ignore it, pretending it doesn't exist. What is it? Well, before I shed some light on it, let's gain some perspective. Imagine the night that Jesus is betrayed. He's praying so intently in the Garden of Gethsemane that he is literally sweating blood. He is moments away from being betrayed and subjected to his torture and crucifixion. For what is he praying? What is it that is so deep in the heart that he erupts to the top of his mind and forms that very last thing that he prayed for prior to his personal agony? What is it? Let's read his prayer. Here's his prayer. My prayer, and quote, "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one, as we are one. I in them and you in me. May they be brought to complete unity to let the world know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." That's John 17, verses 20 through 23. So what was it that he so passionately prayed for? It was the unity of his followers. And what's the elephant in the room? The incredible, mind-blowing division among us. At the moment, there are at least 40,000 different denominations. Additionally, in any one year, there are thousands of church splits. I've personally witnessed three such splits, one for every decade of my Christian walk. You know, it's hard to imagine a situation that could be more the opposite of that for which Christ prayed. Instead of being marked by unity, we are characterized by the exact opposite, division. It is so all-encompassing that it has become embedded in our Christian culture so deeply that it's difficult to imagine any other way. Now, when you meet someone, for example, and we discover that they have a Christian orientation, what's our first question? What church do you go to? Well, our position is, and it's deeply embedded, you can't just be a Christian. You must be a certain flavor of Christian. So let's find out how this person differs from us. It's part of the Christian culture. A friend recently told me about an insight he gained driving through a small town, a one-stop light town. He counted 17 church buildings. Each one, of course, had its own flavored slice of the truth. or traditional practices or organizational scheme or something that separated it from the others. And such, and each attendee at each of those 17 distinct churches had a reason why he or she stuck with that brand rather than the others. They, like most of us, embraced the division. It makes us feel a bit special to think that we have a purer slice of the truth than our brother or sister from the church down the street. That division is so embedded in our culture that we don't even see it. It's the elephant in the room. Probably the biggest reason for that has to do with the position of those who have a vested interest in maintaining the division. And who might they be? Well, it doesn't take a lot of thought to begin to populate the list. Begin with every pastor whose job is on the line if he doesn't keep the folks coming to his brand of church. It extends to the denominational bodies, all those people who make their livings organizing and administering their particular slice of the pie. It extends to the folks in the seminaries who train the pastors, who occupy the pulpits, who tell us not to worry about the division. Truly, there are millions of people who have a vested interest in keeping Christianity divided. And how do they justify it? Well, with this kind of thought, quote, "What looks like division really isn't. We all believe fundamentally the same thing, so it doesn't matter if one of us calls ourselves a Methodist and another calls himself a Baptist. It doesn't matter if we think our local congregation is special and different. It's all just superficial stuff. Don't let it bother you." I mean, that's the response from all the folks who have a vested interest in keeping Christianity divided. And you know, it sounds pretty reasonable. Certainly millions of Christians accept it. There's just one small problem, and that is that exact argument is condemned in the Bible. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 13. Quote, "I appeal to you, brothers, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another, so there may be no divisions among you, and you may be perfectly united in mind and thought. My brothers, some from Chloe's household have informed me that there are quarrels among you. What I mean is this. One of you says, quote, 'I follow Paul,' unquote. Another says, quote, 'I follow Apollos.' Another, quote, 'I follow Cephas.' And still another, 'I follow Christ.' Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized into the name of Paul?" Now that's 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 13. The situation that Paul condemned, he's condemning the division. He's condemning people who are saying you follow somebody and somebody else says, "Well, I follow somebody else." He's condemning it. That is exactly the same situation as we have today. He was speaking to Christians who all believed the same fundamental things. Notice he addressed the letter to those sanctified in Christ Jesus and called to be holy. In other words, he's calling them brothers. He is writing this to Christian brothers who all believe fundamentally the same thing, but that was not good enough for Paul. It wasn't enough that they believed the same things, that they were all Christians. They were chastised for following after one teacher or another. Now, is that not exactly the same situation as we have today, and exactly the same situation that those who gain from division tell us to ignore? It's okay, don't worry about that. Drive by any church building and what you're likely to see in the sign. Really, I mean, take this little test. Just drive around the country. Read the signs in front of church buildings. In more times than not, what you will see is the type of church, in other words, how it's different from all the others, and the name of the pastor. And I guess that's so the members can say, "Well, we belong to Pastor So-and-so's church." That is, of course, exactly the statement that Paul so vehemently condemned. Now, the ugly truth is that the dividers keep us divided. In spite of clear, unambiguous teaching to the contrary, because it serves their vested interest to do so. For example, can you see some denominational body with all its layers of bureaucracy and boards and conventions all at once repenting of its ways? Can you see everyone who makes their living from these organizations stepping down en masse? Well, it's not going to happen because their livelihoods are dependent on that division. Division is the strategy of the institutional church system. Without it, there would be fewer jobs, less need for tithes, and far fewer opportunities for accolades from the audience. So what do you do? Well, the most common reaction is to say something like this. Well, I realize that my church has some problems, but everyone is human, so I'm going to forgive them, stick around, help it to change. I'm going to help make the church better. Okay, now that sounds so reasonable. The unfortunate truth is that it has never worked. The history of Christianity is a story of countless reformations which end up creating even more division and often become guilty of the same flaws that prompted the original quote reformation. What is true on a large scale is also true on the individual level. Tell yourself you're going to help change the church. Come back in 2 years and tell me what's changed. And I'm going to bet that nothing has. The spirits that rule the institutional church system are far too strong for one individual to change. The most effective solution is to recognize the real problem and to address that. The real problem is that we have defined Christianity as churchianity. Let me repeat that. The real problem is that we have defined Christianity as churchianity. We see the world through the perspective of the paradigms of the church that we associate with. As long as we link Christianity with a church, quote unquote, we will continue to splinter and divide. The problem isn't any one church. Instead, the idea is that the problem is that you must belong to a church. You've got to embrace that idea that there is no reason to belong to an institutional church, that doing so actually supports the system of division, which is so roundly and clearly condemned in the Bible. Once you can get your head around that, I don't need to belong to a church. Once you can get your head around that, then you're free to relate to God, to other Christians and non-Christians, without being hindered by the stultifying paradigms of the institutional church system. There's a growing movement of the Lord to usher people out of the institutional church system, and hundreds of thousands have become non-church Christians. They have had the courage to question the tenets of the institutional church system and opted out of the division. They have the courage to seriously consider this question. If, according to Jesus, unity is a sign to the world that He is with us, is our incredible division a sign that He is not? Let me repeat that. If, according to Jesus, unity is a sign to the world that He is with us, is our incredible division a sign that He is not? Perhaps it's time for you to think deeply about it. You know, if you can't change the system, then you should leave it. Do you really want to support a system that Jesus prayed specifically against? Do you really want to support an effort that Paul vehemently and unambiguously condemned? Join the movement. Once you decide to walk away from the institutional church, you take all the power out of the divider's hands. They can't separate you from everyone else if you don't go there. The solution then is simple. Just walk away. Walk out of the church. Don't look back. Get out from under the clouds which characterize involvement with the institutional church. Don't be a part of the system of division that Paul so vehemently condemned, and to which Christ devoted his last prayer. Just walk away. A lot to think about today. That's it. Bye-bye.